takes place Sunday, September 7th, and is a great way to detox after a long summer. Whether you're getting back from Labor Day weekend or decompressing from the burn, this is a great way to stay healthy through dance, foods, and multiple healing modalities. That's A Touch of Portland, Sunday, September 7th at Northwest 17th and Davis. Go to kbu.fm/touchofportland for more information on this event.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Tune in Tuesday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. for The Melting Pot, featuring DJs, producers, and electronic artists from around the globe. Win tickets and stay up on events each and every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. on The Melting Pot, right here at 90.7 FM KBOO.
What's up, everybody? This is Goddess and She, and you're tuning in to KBOO Portland. Holla at your girl. What's up, everybody?
Welcome to Out Loud, the queer culture radio show on KBOO Portland. My name is Carla, and tonight we welcome organizers from the Not Enough Festival, which is happening here in Portland very soon. And before we talk to our guests this evening, I want to let you know how to connect with us online. Our email address is outloudradio@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter by looking for KBOO Out Loud. If you have any feedback on the show, or perhaps you have a community announcement you'd like to share with our listeners, or perhaps you have an idea for a future radio show, feel free to get in touch with us. Again, our email address is outloudradio@gmail.com. Now, we'll be getting to our interview in just a few moments, but before we do that, I want to share a music event that is happening later this week, and I'll be sharing a music sample from one of the musicians. This Thursday evening, Spiracles, Heather Perkins, and the J.T. Wise Band present a varied and festive night of music at the White Eagle Saloon here in Portland, Oregon. Again, this is Thursday, September 4th, starting at 8:30 p.m. This is a free show, and the White Eagle is located at 836 North Russell Street. Now, Spiracles is a Northwest-based alternative rock band, an offshoot of the band The Unknown Soldiers. Heather Perkins is an electronic music do-it-yourself artist who never does the same show twice, and the J.T. Wise Band plays a mix of Americana, rock and blues, and good time jams. Now we're going to take a short musical break and hear a song from Heather Perkins, and we'll be back in just a few moments to hear more about the Not Enough Festival coming to Portland very soon. This song from Heather Perkins is titled Walking Dolly's Dog.
Said, just underscore as he said, the Lord's.
This song is titled Walking Dolly's Dog.
I turned on the radio and I heard a song by Dolly Parton. And she was singing.
Oh.
down here. Well, it's very sexy. My girlfriend Judy and I just came out, dagger, crazy stuff.
Touch your woman.
And then there was Rhinestone. I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
You're a sexist, egotistical, lying, hypocritical bigot.
That's just my blue eye way of brown nosing. Little devils.
Get your buns in here.
Well, it's very sexy.
That song was titled Walking Dolly's Dog from Heather Perkins. Heather is an electronic music artist, do-it-yourself type, who never does the same show twice. Heather is performing with two other bands this Thursday evening, September 4th, at the White Eagle Saloon. The show is free, and it starts at 8:30 p.m. Next, we'd like to welcome our guests to the studio. We have four organizers from the Not Enough Festival. Welcome, people.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you for coming down and sharing the love of queer art with our listeners. First, I'd like to welcome Joseph to the show. Welcome to the studios, Joseph.
Thanks.
So tell us a little bit about the history or the herstory or maybe just the story of the Not Enough Festival and how it all got started.
Yeah, this is the fifth Not Enough Festival ever. It started, over 5 years ago by a group of queer people in Portland who felt that there needed to be more queer art and music in the world. And since then, I wasn't actually part of the first organizing committee. I came and submitted art and was incredibly inspired by it and got involved the following year. And each year it's been a really amazing group of submissions and bands that have formed for the festival. Many of the bands have gone on and kept performing. And also, and during these 5 years, so it's been other Not Enoughs that have happened in other communities. New Orleans has a yearly one. There's been one in Winnipeg. And this year we got emails from people in Olympia and Edmonton asking about starting their own Not Enough festivals.
That's so exciting. So the passion of the Portland Not Enough is actually kind of rippling out into other communities.
Yeah, definitely. And also this group of organizers, out of the current organizing group, there's two of us who have been involved before with organizing the festival. So it's all new folks and new energy and ideas.
How exciting. Now, Jack, maybe tell us, what's your role with the festival this year?
Sure. So I actually got involved after seeing some of my friends in New Orleans organizing a Not Enough Festival there, and they sort of have like a different take on the theme. Ours is pretty broad. Anybody who's like queer or trans identified and wants to make art or music or film can submit something new, as long as it's a brand new collaborative work. And New Orleans has their own style. They sort of think that like there's not enough people, not enough like people of color and women and queer people doing in the punk scene there. So they're specifically just doing punk bands. And so it's kind of cool to see like how each town interprets the theme. And so that's like kind of how I got involved, seeing like moving to Portland in the fall and getting involved that way. And so we all take on different parts of the work. I think like we've all been watching over the submissions and sort of pushing it online. Katie works at the music venue where we're going to be having the show, which has been a really helpful in. And Kat was in one of the bands that formed 2 years ago. And so like we've all sort of come at this from different angles, which is exciting.
Right on. And so that's a good segue. So Katie, tell us about the venue. Where and when is the festival going to be happening?
The Not Enough Festival is going to be this upcoming Sunday, the 7th, at Slabtown. Slabtown is located at 1033 Northwest 16th Avenue. It's right on the corner of 16th and Marshall. The doors are opening at 6, and we're going to be having some snacks and an art show right at 6, so make sure you show up early. We'll be taking donations at the door that will benefit the various costs associated with the festival, but no one is going to be turned away for lack of funds. All ages are welcome, and there is a bar if you are of age, and it's going to be really exciting.
Right on. And you said doors at 6 or 6:30?
Doors at 6.
Doors at 6 this Sunday the 7th.
Yes.
Excellent. Okay. And Kat, what's your role with the festival this year?
Well, in a lot of ways, I've been working on graphics and the visual end of things. I found the festival a couple years ago and started a band called Labrys, and we're still playing out there making queer feminist metal. And so yeah, I've been doing, this year is the first year that I've gotten involved with organizing the festival, and I've done a lot of the graphics work and helping organize the logistics.
Mm-hmm. Right on. Are you going to be performing this year?
I am. Yeah. So the one part of the Not Enough Challenge for a lot of people is a little bit of a last minute call to action, and I wanted to really embrace that. I'm a drummer. I've been playing drums since I was in the seventh grade, and I've always wanted to experiment with and grow as someone who plays electric guitar, because I don't really play electric guitar at all. And so I have a band this year called Space Goat. It's a little one-off.
Okay.
And I'm gonna get on stage and give it my damnedest, my
right on.
Best.
Right on. And just to clarify, so you had mentioned that the band that you've been in was a band that started at Not Enough a couple years ago.
That's right.
But again, one of the key philosophies around the Not Enough Fest is that it has to be a new collaboration, right? So all the art and performances are stuff that people haven't seen before, right?
Yeah, the whole point is that we're trying to build community also, in addition to putting more art and music out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Kat's starting this whole new band, pushing herself to play guitar in a band. I started a band last week myself with a few friends, and we've never played together before. And so I wrote the lyrics to my first song ever.
Woo-hoo!
This last week. So it's just exciting to challenge ourselves to do that too.
That's great.
And these bands may not endure, but that's not necessarily the test of success. Mm-hmm. The success is that we're building community power, right? Like we're building these relationships, we're meeting each other, we're performing for each other and learning each other's names. And it's little things like that that make us more resilient as a queer community.
Mm-hmm. And for the love of more art, that's an obvious outcome as well, right on. And so I know the submission deadline passed, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yesterday.
Yesterday. Okay. Sorry, listeners. Hopefully you got your stuff in. And so now you all have the extra special challenge of making some decisions. But maybe tell us a little bit, like, how many bands, or kind of let us know what you're sorting through with these applications that you got.
Yeah. I've been spending all day doing that, actually. Hopefully nobody at work is listening to this. But you know, maybe at our last meeting, like 2 weeks ago, we had something like 4 or 5 submissions, and we were sort of scared that there wasn't going to be a festival. And then suddenly we have 24 submissions, and that includes 9 bands and 4 different sort of performance art type things, a bunch of visual art and some film too. And those range from everything from, you know, punk bands to hip hop projects to comedy duos to like film and found like instrument music. Some people are going to be drawing portraits together of people at the show. So that people really interpreted collaboration in some wild ways. It's super cool.
It's a beautiful thing. For listeners who might have just joined the conversation, my name's Carla. You're listening to Out Loud, the queer culture radio show here on KBOO. And here in studio with me are 4 of the organizers from the Not Enough Festival, which is happening this weekend, Sunday, September 7th, at Slabtown, which is close to 16th and Marshall. It's an all-ages free show. Now, for folks that want to find you guys online, what's the best way for folks to connect with you?
We're on Facebook and Tumblr. We're also kind of on Twitter. But if you look for us, Not Enough Fest, our Facebook and Tumblr are the ways to get us.
Yeah, also... yeah, Google Not Enough PDX. It's all us, so.
Okay, yeah. Right on. Okay, now, what can folks expect when they come to the festival on Sunday? So you mentioned some music stuff. There are going to be some people on the side doing the portrait drawing thing, and without giving away any big secrets or anything, but what else can you, like, what can people expect?
So much. Well, you know, so many bands. I'm really blown away by how many submissions we have. And to be honest, what is so exciting about organizing this is we don't totally know what to expect either, because this is new to us. Yeah. And the submissions closed last night. So we're going to look at them now. And as Jack said, I don't know. I'm just going through the submissions, and I'm so incredibly excited to see all the different art because so many of it looks so amazing, and some of it looks kind of weird too, in a really great way. So,
okay. Now, this is kind of a surprise question. I didn't ask these folks ahead of time, but does anybody want to share, like, maybe what were some of your favorite performances from years past? You know, like some of the highlights besides your own that brought you to organizing. I'm sure that was remarkable. But things that you saw that really kind of blew you away or left a mark on you. Mm-hmm. Okay, so
I've got a quick story. So my band Labrys, we have played quite a few times now with what we identify as our sister band, Cockeye. Blake, if you're listening, I love you. They came out at the Not Enough 2012 that Labrys emerged from. And it was one of the first times that I'd seen like sweet feminist fags playing punk rock. And it felt like a big deal. And we immediately all became friends and have played a ton of shows together now. And it will live in my heart forever as an incredibly amazing and touching moment.
I'll agree. It sounds amazing. Yeah. Like the aligning of the stars. And I'm so glad you were there. So I was not there. I'm sorry I missed it.
Yeah. Okay. I was going to say, in terms of one of my favorite performances was actually Cat's Band at Labyrinth's first show at that Not Enough. And the singer who was with them at the time saying something that was, I don't remember the exact words, so you can correct me, but it was essentially like, I want you all to know that we've never played a show before, and I never didn't sing with this band till that day or this week. And then she said something in the lines of, and I'm not saying this as an apology, I'm saying it because I'm proud. And then they did this incredible set, and I don't know, it was really incredibly inspiring.
Right on. The things that people bring together, it's wonderful. Okay, so I know with the festival happening this Sunday, there's going to be music. Is there going to be food? I mean, it is a bar. We mentioned that it's there'll be alcohol available for people of age.
Yeah, so Slabtown is a bar. Like I said, the bar will be available, and there's also food available. There's the Falafel House at Slabtown, which has the most delicious vegan falafel in the city. I'm just going to go ahead and put that out there. there will be snacks available, like I said beforehand, during the art viewing also, which is pretty exciting.
Yeah, get there early.
Yeah, okay, definitely get there early.
While they last. Okay. So the art viewing, has there been art that's been submitted, or is it a different art show that's already on the wall at Slabtown?
No, it's all new art, new collaborative art for this festival.
Never before seen.
Yeah.
Okay, so art on the walls for people to check out. And that was all submitted by yesterday as well. So basically, you guys now have all the art to sort through.
Yeah, we have the difficult responsibility of trying to figure out how to fit all of these amazing performances and pieces into one evening. It's going to be really challenging, but a great challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, plan to show up and stay for quite a long time, because we're going to have art, and then we're going to have a brief segment of films, and then we're going to have bands, likely many bands, and then we're going to have a dance party.
How exciting. Okay, and this is all, again, if you've just tuned in and you missed the location, the Not Enough Festival is happening at Slabtown. So it sounds like there'll be a lot of different stuff going on. For folks that cannot come to the festival on Sunday, I'm sure there are some sad faces and some broken hearts out there. But for whatever reason, if a listener or listeners want to support you guys but cannot actually come to the festival on Sunday, what are some other ways that people can show their support?
Well, definitely, especially for folks who do not live in Portland, is start a Not Enough Festival and create more queer art and culture in the world.
Hell yeah.
Okay, and they can find you through the Facebook or the Tumblr or your online stuff?
Yeah, Not Enough PDX.
Okay, yeah. Do a search for that, okay.
Yeah. We also have fundraisers and events throughout the year. You know, one of the fan favorites is Riot Girl Karaoke, which we're hoping to do more often throughout the course of the year, which is live bands playing Riot Girl songs and people getting to sing them karaoke style over the top of it. Yeah, so we're hoping to make something happen more long-term.
Very exciting. Do you guys need volunteers the day of the event?
Show up. We'll find something for you to do, I'm sure. Okay. But if not, you could just eat snacks and enjoy the art.
Okay, great. I guess I just wanted to acknowledge Katie had mentioned, you know, you guys will be taking donations at the door, and nobody turned away for lack of funds. But for folks that are living on a budget and maybe want to give their time or something like that, that sounds like maybe you could use some extra hands if anybody's interested. Okay.
Mostly we want you there. We want your body there. We want your mind there. We want your participation, because queer culture is what we make together.
Right on. And what can we expect after the festival? So we mentioned more fundraisers to keep things going into the future. Everybody kind of takes a break for a little while, I would guess, all you organizer types. And then when does the planning start for next year? Or dare I even ask? Everybody's looking around like, oh no, not next year.
Something that's been also incredibly inspiring of being involved in this festival through the years is each year is so incredibly different. And this year has a different feel than the previous years. And So I am really happy to say I have no idea what to expect next. I think that's incredibly exciting. Folks should contact us if they want to get involved in organizing Future Not Enoughs. Yeah, we'll see what happens.
Okay. Kind of the joy of the new collaboration that we'll see what comes out of this festival. Very exciting. Okay, well, I hate to say it. The clock is ticking and we're starting to run out of time. But I want to say a huge thank you. We've had Katie, Kat, Jack, and Joseph here in studio with us. They are a part of the organizing team from the Not Enough Festival happening here in town Sunday, September 7th, this coming weekend, over at Slab Town. Now, I want to give each of you a chance to share any closing thoughts with our listeners or anything else you wanted to be sure we talked about tonight.
If you are looking for more queer-related events to participate in, Slabtown does have a weekly queer night, which is every Tuesday night. Today's Tuesday. And it's including a variety of events like DJs, live music shows. We have the Les Stand-Up Comedy Group once a month also. It's really exciting.
Right on. Do you know a website or where folks can find that calendar?
Yeah, the best way to find that out would be on Facebook. It's called Yes Homo. So if you just look up Yes Homo on Facebook, it should pop up.
Okay, great. Thank you for that.
Because I've also got some stuff to plug. You can check out, I put on a night called Queer Aggression, which was very, very much so inspired from the Not Enough Music, Not Enough Festival. And it is a... Oh, God, I'm forgetting my words. It is a show focused around celebrating queer artists who make aggressive and dark and loud music of the rock and punk and metal and industrial and grunge and goth, etc. variety. And
where can folks find out when that happens?
That you can just search for Queer Aggression and or find us on Facebook.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm also organizing another show. You know, I think part of this experience has been finding new collaborators. So through Katie, I got hooked up with the Church of Rock and Roll at Slabtown, and they do Saturday matinees, which are really awesome. And so I'm going to be booking a show there on November 8th with Agatha and My Parade from Seattle and Olympia. That's going to be benefiting a bunch of like amazing Mestiza Chicana folks going down to Mexico to make some really awesome queer art out of that. So I'm excited to be doing more of these collaborations in the future.
Yeah, the Church of Rock and Roll is another exciting project that happens at Slabtown. It's a volunteer-run collective that puts on all-ages shows. We usually have at least once a week, and it's really exciting. You can also find that on Facebook at the Church of Rock and Roll at Slabtown.
Right on. And just a big shout-out to everyone who's doing all-ages shows. I keep hearing from young people, we need more of that. So props to everybody who's doing that kind of work out there. And Joseph, I guess any closing thoughts that you want to leave with our listeners?
Yeah, I guess just one more of just to point out that something that's so great about Not Enough is it's such a community event. And there's four of us in the room. There are other organizers involved. There's been lots of other volunteers, bands that have performed benefits from us. The original organizers who are out doing other amazing art and activism in the world. It's just been a really awesome community experience.
Right on. Well, and thank you. That was a perfect note to kind of wrap things up, Joseph. Thank you for that. And a big shout out to everyone who's been involved. I know over the many years, I guess this is the fifth year of Not Enough. We probably don't have enough time to name everybody who's been involved. But if you're listening, big kudos to you. And looking forward to seeing a lot of happy faces at the show this Sunday night. Again, the important details for the Not Enough Festival happening this Sunday, September 7th, doors at 6. And like Kat said, plan to stay late. It's all happening at Slabtown, which is down at close to 16th and Marshall Street. So thank you so much to everyone for coming in and being part of the show this evening.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Keep up the good work, people. And now, listeners, stay tuned. We need to say goodbye, but stay tuned for This Way Out, which is the International Gay and Lesbian News Magazine. My name is Carla. Next week, Alan will be back to host the show. And we want to say from the bottom of our hearts, thank you so much for listening. Until next time, stay proud and live out loud.
Mr. Fisher, can you identify any other contexts of state law besides marriage where you believe that classifying people based upon their sexual orientation would serve legitimate state interests?
I don't know of any other.
Here are people who actually want to have children. It is not accidental. They make that commitment to raise the children. I just don't get that.
Men and women create babies, and there has to be a social mechanism for dealing with them.
Do you criminalize fornication?
I'm sorry, what?
Criminalize fornication?
No, no longer.
Would you like to?
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Ecuador engages civil unions, three countries adopt rights for same-gender parents, and a U.S. appeals court scoffs at bad breeder behavior-based inequality. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wendell Jones.
And I'm Carol Myers.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending August 30th, 2014. Ecuador's President Rafael Correa announced this week that same-gender couples will be able to enter into civil unions in the tiny Northwest South American country starting on September 15th. Lesbian and gay couples who do so will be entitled to the same rights as heterosexual couples in legally recognized marriages or civil unions. Ecuador's 2009 constitution bans civil marriage for gay and lesbian couples, but also provides for the legal recognition of committed, unmarried, heterosexual relationships. Correa's announcement expands that recognition to same-gender couples. The president was unequivocal, telling the South American television network Telesur that if someone is turned away by a government employee, that employee will be dismissed for denying constitutional rights. Correa also promised that all Ecuadorians in civil unions, regardless of the partner's sexual orientation or gender, would be able to have their civil union status reflected on their national identification cards. Only heterosexual married couples have been able to include that information until now. Among other niceties, the cards allow access to many government benefits, some of which are specific to partners in civil unions. This week's announcement stems from a summit between LGBT activists and the president on August 18th. While it's not marriage equality in the heavily Roman Catholic country, and same-gender couples can't adopt, both of which Correa has staunchly opposed, Ecuadorian trans and feminist activist Diane Rodriguez told Think Progress that opening civil unions to same-gender couples is like giving us full citizenship.
Attorneys for three same-gender couples at the heart of the challenge to the U.S. state of Utah's law denying such couples access to civil marriage have joined the state's Republican Attorney General, Sean Reyes, in asking the U.S. Supreme Court to review the case. The 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals agreed in June with an earlier district court ruling that the ban violates the federal constitution. Reyes filed the state's appeal with the High Court on August 5th. Attorneys for Virginia and Oklahoma have also asked the high court justices to review cases overturning their bans on civil marriage for same-gender couples. The Supreme Court is not obligated to hear any appeals, but most observers predict that, if nothing else, the sheer volume of marriage equality rulings around the country will force justices to hear at least one of those cases, possibly as soon as next year.
In what may have been the most lopsided hearing so far in a federal appeals court considering state marriage bans, a three-judge panel of the Chicago-based 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals this week all but annihilated arguments to maintain the bans by attorneys for the states of Indiana and Wisconsin. Led by Reagan appointee Richard Posner, all three judges challenged the logic of virtually every argument each attorney advanced to defend their law.
Is there some empirical basis for anything you have said?
The empirical basis that men and women create babies and there has to be a social mechanism for dealing with them.
The best interests of children were a major focus in each almost hour-long hearing.
Indiana and Wisconsin lawyers argued that keeping marriage exclusively heterosexual was necessary to encourage responsible procreation. Attorneys for the plaintiff couple stressed the benefits to children headed by same-gender couples if civil marriage is open to their parents. We'll have highly entertaining and insightful highlights from the Indiana hearing in a few minutes on many of these same This Way Out stations.
Coupled same-gender parents and their children made news in three countries this week. Pink News reported that a gay couple in Switzerland has become the first to be legally recognized as the parents of a child. Even though surrogacy is illegal in Switzerland, the couple, living in a Swiss civil partnership, is now recognized as the legal parents of the child born to a surrogate mother. She and her husband legally abdicated their parental responsibilities. The Swiss Justice Department challenged the action of the local registry office in court. The ruling recognizing the two men as fathers partly acknowledged the concerns of the Justice Department by requiring the genetic parentage of the child to be included on his birth certificate. The Justice Department could still appeal the ruling.
A non-biological parent in Italy has become the first in that country to be allowed to legally adopt the child of her lesbian partner. Italy's La Repubblica newspaper reported that the now 5-year-old girl was born to one of the two women after she underwent fertility treatment abroad, and that the child was already living with a couple at their home in Rome. The juvenile court ruling was the first in Italy to allow second-parent adoption by a same-gender partner.
A non-biological lesbian parent in Colombia has also become the first in her country to be allowed to adopt her partner's offspring. According to an Associated Press report, Anna Lederman gave birth to two children via artificial insemination. Her longtime partner, Veronica Botero, however, had no parental rights over the children, now ages 4 and 6. The couple petitioned for second-parent adoption rights after the first child was born. While the constitutional court ruling applies to only couples where one member is a biological parent, legal experts say it could indicate the high court's willingness to extend adoption rights to all same-gender couples in Colombia.
In other news, Berlin's long-serving out mayor Klaus Wowereit announced this week that he'll be stepping down in December after leading Germany's capital city for the past 13 years. The popular Social Democrat was credited with making his city a major international tourist destination, calling Berlin poor but sexy, and attracting young travelers in particular from around the world. However, huge cost overruns and charges of corruption and shoddy planning that have delayed the opening of Berlin's Willy Brandt Airport, scheduled for 2010 but still under construction, have seriously eroded Wowereit's support, and he decided to quit 2 years before another election was due. "I go voluntarily, and I am proud of my contribution to the positive development of the city," he said. After some 40 years in Berlin politics, he thanked city residents for giving him the chance to make a career out of my biggest hobby. Wowereit famously dismissed worries about his sexuality being a barrier to winning office prior to his election in 2001 by saying, "I am gay, and that's okay." He's been with his partner, Jorn Kubicki, a neurosurgeon, since 1993.
Elsewhere, 24-year-old Patricia Llerena Rodriguez, Miss Spain in both the 2008 and 2013 Miss Universe pageants, came out as a lesbian last week through an Instagram post, making her what's believed to be the first openly lesbian international beauty queen. The picture, captioned Romeo and Juliet, shows Rodriguez in an intimate moment with girlfriend Vanessa Klein, a Spanish DJ and singer. Rodriguez tweeted her thanks for all the support she's received. But as She Wired noted, Rodriguez may well be the last Miss Spain winner for a while, since the company running the Miss Universe competition filed for bankruptcy in 2013.
And finally, the coming out of a second beauty queen in as many weeks has truly international implications. The Rose of Tralee is a competition in which Irish communities around the world send a beauty queen to the finals in Ireland's County Kerry. This year's winner, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania resident Maria Walsh, came out as lesbian this week in an interview with the Irish Sun newspaper. The 27-year-old discussed the support she's received from her family, saying that, "I told my parents and they were supportive, as I knew they would be. I'm not ashamed of my sexuality by any means," she said. "The Rose of Tralee is about celebrating women's intelligence, careers, and their volunteer work," she added. "The question of sexuality never came up. To me, being gay is normal. It's natural." Rose of Tralee Executive International Chairman Anthony O'Gara said the festival was delighted to have chosen Ms. Walsh as this year's Rose, noting that she is a wonderful person, an attractive, intelligent woman, and a very worthy winner who happens to be gay.
But as blogger Joe My God noted, the revelation by the reigning Rose might be a bit of a problem for the Ancient Order of Hibernians, organizers of New York City's annual St. Patrick's Day parade. The Roman Catholic Church-affiliated group continues to ban any LGBT-identified contingent from marching in the world's largest and oldest such celebration. Traditionally, like every prior winner of the Rose of Tralee Festival, dubbed a global celebration of Irish culture, Walsh is supposed to be feted and fawned over during next year's St. Patrick's Day season in New York. It could be interesting to see how the parade sponsors greet the now-out lesbian beauty queen.
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 30th, 2014. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Carol Myers.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
Children were at the heart of the arguments about marriage equality in hearings on August 26th at the Chicago-based 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Attorneys for Indiana and Wisconsin each defended his state's ban on civil marriage for same-gender couples as necessary to the promotion of responsible procreation. Attorneys for the plaintiff couples stressed the inequities faced by the children of same-gender couples because their parents are denied civil marriage. But everyone's been talking about how the three-judge panel, led by Ronald Reagan appointee Richard Posner, pulverized every argument to maintain their civil marriage bans that the state attorneys offered. We've got highlights in a few moments from the Indiana hearing. But we want to start first with some brief comments about those hearings by BuzzFeed's Chris Geidner on MSNBC's Up with Steve Kornacki. The voices you'll hear then belong to Judge Posner, Bill Clinton appointee Judge Ann Claire Williams, and Obama appointee Judge David Hamilton. The victim of their legal rending was Indiana Solicitor General Thomas Fisher. Geidner described what he witnessed this week as something else.
I've been attending all of these arguments across the country, and it was an environment unlike any that we've seen in any of these other cases. I mean, Judge Posner was just crushing each of the lawyers from the two states in their attempt to defend the bans. And then even when he wasn't doing it, the other two judges, Judge Williams, and then there was also Judge Hamilton who was hearing the case, both of them were sort of the nicer version of the same sort of arguments mm-hmm. that Judge Posner was giving. And when we got into it and within the first 5 minutes of the argument, it became sort of clear where the judges were going to be going, that it sort of the tone lightened mm-hmm. and people started sort of chuckling along as these questions got more and more brutal.
I think the issue here is to deal with what may be a fleeting moment of passion that leads to a child that nobody contemplated. And how do we deal with that? And the idea with marriage is to channel that behavior into a specific institution.
You criminalize fornication.
I'm sorry, what?
Criminalize fornication?
No, no longer.
Would you like to?
I don't know. I mean, it's not an issue here. The legislature hasn't done that for some time.
It sounds like a way of dealing with this unintended child
problem. It's one thing to criminalize.
You don't seem to like adoption as a way of dealing with it.
That is not true. It's not that we don't like it, that we are grateful for adoption.
So why do you prefer heterosexual adoption to homosexual adoption?
We don't.
Of course you do. You give all sorts of benefits to the heterosexual adoptive parents and no benefits to the homosexual adoptive parents.
Well, no, this is not...
You must have a reason for that.
Well, the benefits that you're talking about are not triggered based on sexuality. They're based, of course, on marital status, which
yes,
is...
Like, come on now. You're going in circles. The question is, why do you want the children who are adopted by same-sex couples, of whom there appear to be a couple hundred thousand, why do you want them to be worse off? Because they don't have these financial and psychological benefits of having married parents. You allow the homosexual couples to adopt. Why don't you want their children to have the same advantages as children adopted by heterosexual couples?
The question is, what can we do to nudge heterosexual couples who may produce children unintentionally to plan for this, to plan for the consequences and appreciate the consequences of sexual behavior. Those consequences don't arise with same-sex couples. It's not in the context of adoption that that marriage was
crafted. But you're not answering my question. You've got millions of adopted children, and a lot of them, the 200,000 or more, are adopted by same-sex couples. Why don't you want their children to be as well off as the adopted children of heterosexual couples?
The marriage scheme is set up not with adoption in mind. It's set up with what dealing with the consequences.
That's a kind of weakness, isn't it?
Well, no. In fact, we're looking here at an institution that goes back to when, you know, there was a fundamental problem dealing with unintended babies.
Why does Indiana let sterile people marry?
I think the law goes as far as it reasonably can in defining marriage according to this theory of responsible procreation.
We don't allow incest, right?
We allow incest? We don't allow incest.
First cousin.
Oh, I'm sorry, over 65. Yeah, I think there again, the assumption being that there would be infertility at that stage.
Mr. Fisher, can you identify any other contexts of state law besides marriage where you believe that classifying people based upon their sexual orientation would serve legitimate state interests?
Well, first, I have to push back against the premise. You said other. I don't think this is that sort of circumstance. But if the question is, are there...
Then we get into the game. Is it sex discrimination or sexual orientation discrimination? Surely the purpose here is clear. But let's get past that point,
right,
and please address the question.
I don't know of any other.
Wouldn't you agree that marriage is not just about having children, but about raising children? You agree there are two components?
Oh, yes.
Okay, then are you saying same-sex couples cannot successfully raise children?
Absolutely not.
Well, if Indiana's law is about successfully raising children and you agree same-sex couples can successfully raise children, why shouldn't the ban be lifted?
I think the assumption is that with opposite-sex couples, there is very little thought given during the sexual act sometimes to whether babies may be a consequence.
So because gay and homosexual couples actually choose to be parents, choose to take on that obligation, that difference of choice is you're setting that up differently than accidental. So I mean, here are people who actually want to have children, know they want to have children. It is not accidental. They make that commitment to raise the children. I just don't get that.
Well,
it's
another
aspect of what Judge Posner is raising.
And I think the working assumption there, Your Honor, is that in that circumstance, the state doesn't need to nudge those couples to stay together. There already is that working understanding. With opposite-sex couples, it may be a fleeting moment of passion that leads to a child. And that's what we're trying to address.
Isn't there a strong interest in kids to be adopted?
Of course.
If you allow same-sex marriage, you're going to have more adopters, right?
I don't know that that's true.
Well, it's much cheaper to adopt a child if you're married because you get all these benefits from the state and the federal government. You should be wanting to enlist people in as adopters so you can minimize. What is pathetic? You got 10,000 foster care children in Indiana. Don't you want to get them adopted?
You're talking about prioritizing competing issues.
No,
and that's
the
legislature's
job. I don't see
the job.
Competing issue. What's
the legislature has an understanding of marriage that it has decided to preserve, and it's based on...
But it's arbitrary. It doesn't serve any public... I mean, you allow all these sterile people to get married. Why are you doing that? If you're so concerned with procreation, why are you letting them get married?
We couldn't constitutionally inquire. I think all this is a reflection of biology. It's simply that men and women make babies and same-sex couples do not.
But I think you made a very telling statement when you Judge Posner asked you about brothers and sisters marrying, and you said a transgression against social norm. I mean, isn't that really your fundamental problem or concern?
No, I think our...
That the gay marriages really boil down to that.
No, I think that we're purely...
Particularly when you look at the history, as Judge Hamilton has pointed out, of the persecution of gay people in our society.
No, I think what we're talking about here is purely utilitarian. It's purely a matter of men and women make babies and same-sex couples do not. And we have to have a mechanism for dealing with those babies, and marriage is that mechanism.
The problem is that the adoptive parents who are a homosexual couple and the adoptive parents who are heterosexual... What is the difference from the standpoint of the child welfare? Apparently not, because you don't put any barriers. You allow You allow joint adoption by a homosexual couple, so you must think they make reasonable parents. So why don't you want to give them the same benefits as other parents of adopted children?
Because the policy is formulated with an eye towards what's
happening. I want a reason. Why? What's the reason? Do you really think you get less extramarital sex or something by these rules?
Well,
evidence, right?
The policy is not
evidence. You don't deal in facts.
Policy is not formulated with an eye towards jumping in the middle of an understood and well-established relationship. It's formulated with the idea of we don't know what's going to happen with any particular couple, and with the idea that we know that opposite-sex couples...
Well, that's loving, right? Nobody knew how interracial marriage was going to work.
No, I'm talking about the production of babies here. I'm talking about we don't know which couples are going to reproduce and which not. All we know is that opposite-sex couples can you know reproduce even if they don't intend to on the heat of the moment.
But you let all these sterile people marry.
But we don't know who they are, and we can't...
You know with the cousins, right?
We can't inquire...
It's ridiculous, if you don't mind my saying so. You have some 80-year-old cousins who've gotten married, and you say that's a model for family formation, will encourage young people to marry.
Well, I think that's part of it. And the other part...
That front, is there evidence about that model?
No, it's self-evident is the only thing.
I regard it as absurd. You say it's self-evident,
well,
right? Is there some empirical basis for anything you have said?
The empirical basis that men and women create babies, and there has to be a social mechanism for dealing with them.
That was Indiana Solicitor General Thomas Fisher in a losing legal battle with Judges Richard Posner and Claire Williams and David Hamilton of the 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. While it's a little hard to believe, many observers said that Wisconsin Assistant Attorney General Timothy C. Samuelson fared even worse during his state's hearing. Camilla Taylor, Lambda Legal's Marriage Project Director, and Kenneth Falk, Legal Director of the ACLU of Indiana, represented the Hoosier State plaintiff couples. Taylor referenced the Windsor case during her arguments, last year's U.S. Supreme Court ruling that struck down key provisions of the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA. She also profiled one of the plaintiff couples, Glenn Funkhauser and Henry Green, who've been in a loving, committed relationship for 22 years and are raising a now 12-year-old son. Specifically citing Lawrence v. Texas, the landmark Supreme Court ruling that overturned state sodomy laws, Falk also addressed slippery slope assertions during his arguments that opening civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples will lead to the legalization of everything from bestiality to polygamy.
The reasons for protecting our liberty to choose whom we marry, I think, are outlined in the Turner case pretty comprehensively. They have to do with what marriage means as a timeless and universal matter for all of us. And that has to do with dedication and public support and commitment, but it also has to do with the way government provides benefits and protections. And specifically for Glenn and Henry, for example, who were licensed as foster parents, the state placed a child in their home. They came here because they want their child to be able to grow up understanding that his family is worth just as much as any other family. So by denying that couple the right to marry, the state has done exactly what was identified in Windsor as the harm of DOMA in denying marital respect to same-sex couples. It has not only demeaned the couple itself by refusing to allow them to make that choice for themselves, but it has also humiliated the children in these families, and it has deprived them of the ability to understand the integrity and the closeness of their own families, to quote Windsor.
Justice Scalia in Lawrence noted, in dissent, that procreation is not a qualification for marriage. And even if there was some tenuous relationship, there is no explanation, nor is there possibly one apparent, as to how allowing same-sex couples to marry would in any way affect whatever interest the state has, particularly because the state allows hordes of opposite-sex people who are not procreating to marry. Ultimately, in their reply brief, the state seems to try and expand this notion of responsible procreation beyond the minute of procreation to raising children. But there, of course, as the court has noted out, we reach an even more obvious equal protection problem, because as far as the child is concerned, that child has the exact same needs and can have the exact same benefit and security from their parents being married, regardless of whether their parents are same sex or opposite sex. And of course, at its most basic.
Or whether the child was intended or not.
Of course. Most children don't grow up thinking, I was intended, I wasn't intended. And most parents tend not to think that way about their children, at least eventually.
The arguments against polygamy sound an awful lot like the arguments against gay marriage.
Well, nothing has to change about marriage, Your Honor, as we've seen in 19 states in the District of Columbia, except elimination of the gendered entry barrier.
The strongest argument against recognizing polygamy, then, is simply the challenge of rewriting the laws to deal with, for example, inheritance rules for multiple spouses instead of for just one?
Your Honor, that case would have to rise or fall on its own merits.
There is no slippery slope. The lesson of Lawrence and the lesson of the marriage cases is that we cannot look behind and say we don't want those people to exercise a right of sexual intimacy or we don't want those people to marry. Going back to my mathematical diagram of marriage, if you have two people in it, regardless of their sexes, the formula is going to look exactly the same. It's going to look like marriage.
Why shouldn't we let the Supreme Court make that decision?
I don't think any of us have any illusion about the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court is eventually going to decide and hear and decide a marriage case. But in the meantime, as every single court that has faced the question has held, I think it's incumbent upon the lower courts to recognize that the arc of legal history, if not actual history, has long passed Baker by. This statute is unconstitutional. The district court was correct, and the district court should be affirmed.
Attorneys for the Indiana Marriage Equality Plaintiffs, Kenneth Falk and Camilla Taylor. And finally, a brief but insightful comment from Freedom to Marry founder Evan Wolfson on that same MSNBC program this week about the Seventh Circuit's Judge Posner.
Judge Posner in 1997 wrote an article in which he was reviewing a book advocating for the freedom to marry. And what he really said was, whether or not there's a constitutional right, and probably there is, it's unrealistic to expect the courts to get too far ahead of the public. The country's not ready, he said in 1997. And here he was leading the charge now in court the other day, saying it's time for this discrimination to end. There is no good reason for it.
It's not the pot that grows the flower. It's not the clock that slows the hour. The definition's plain for anyone to see. Love is all it takes to make a family. The definition's plain for anyone to see. Love is all it takes to make a family.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Wenzel Jones and Carol Myers contributed program material with thanks, as always, to Steve Pride. Romanofsky and Phillips crooned Love Is All It Takes, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out also thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, and our generous listeners for making this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KRCL Salt Lake City, Utah, 6RTR Perth, Australia, WVEW Brattleboro, Vermont, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned!
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard around the world at www.kbu.fm. The time is 6:59. Stay tuned for Hard Knock Radio coming up next.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the White Bear Polar Tundra album release show on Saturday, September 6th at 9 p.m. Opening bands include The Great Hiatum and Snow Roller. White Bear Polar Tundra stands for environmental progress with a conscientious DIY ethic, and their debut album, Strikes Back, is their effort to create progressive, head-turning music. This show is playing at Alhambra Theater, located at 4811 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information about this KBOO co-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Triple Divide, fracking documentary on Friday, September 12th at 7 p.m. Triple Divide, directed by Public Herald investigative journalist Joshua Prubanik and Melissa Troutman, deconstructs the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection's handling of shale gas development through fracking, and will uncover how DEP and the industry have handled violations within Pennsylvania's highest classified watersheds, what happened in the 2011 Bradford County blowout, water contamination complaints, health issues, and the split estate landowner dispute. Triple Divide, fracking documentary will be showing at the First Unitarian Church in the Elliott Chapel, located at Southwest 12th and Salmon Street in Portland. More information about this KBOO